Ladies and gentlemen, we are delighted to welcome you into another edition of the Heart of the Emergency Worker podcast series. The Heart of the Emergency Worker podcast series lives right here at BransonPodcastNetwork.com. It is powered and presented by our friends at Arvest Bank. In studio, I am Josh Grisham, joined by my co-host and creator of this podcast series, Pam Yancey. Pam, it is good to be joined back in studio again. We have another story to tell here for the podcast series. Good to have you back, my dear.
It is great to be here, Josh, and I am looking forward to this story. We've heard some great stories over the past few podcasts, and I'm sure this one's going to be just as great as all the other ones are. So happy to be here today.
Yes, no doubt about it. We have many, many stories to tell. And of course, we want to remind folks the latest edition of the podcast series, Heart of the Emergency Worker podcast series, features Dustin Lunau, and that is available right now on the network. That is our latest episode. We've gotten some great plays on that. And folks, also want to encourage you, our heroes are the narrative. They are the centerpiece of this podcast series. If you would like to make a nomination, you can do that under the webpage. It is BransonPodcastNetwork.com. Just search for Heart of the Emergency Worker podcast series. Click on the logo, and the nomination form is the very first thing you will see. It is easy to do, and we would love to share that story here on the series. So make a nomination today and be a part of this wonderful series. Our featured guest, I tell you what, it was an easy yes, because we have really dug deep, Pam. We have been talking to multiple facets. We've been talking about law enforcement. We have been talking about the sheriff's department. We've been talking about emergency line workers. And we have also been talking about the ambulance district. And at this point right now, this is going to be our third in the series talking about fire. Fire. Yes. This is a big one for us, because really, the whole series was born, and our fire chief, Ted Martin, led off the series, which was a wonderful way to kick things off. And now we have got a young man that comes to us in this series that works right along Ted, along the Branson Fire Department here in Ozark Mountain Country, and that's a big deal.
It is a big deal, and we all love Ted Martin. There is no doubt about that. He has a heart for our community. He is so involved, and I've never met anyone that said they didn't like Ted, and if they did, I'd probably arm wrestle him or something, you know.
I know.
But I just saw him earlier today down at City Hall, and he is everywhere. And so we're excited to hear the story from you, because you get to work with him all the time. So anyway, we want to hear your story.
And so we want to welcome into the studio in this series, Joshua Baim. And Joshua, as I understand, you are battalion chief. So let me start there. Battalion chief, sir, what does that entail? And welcome to the series.
Well, thank you for having me. It's exciting to be here. So a battalion chief, there's three of them within our organization. And we are responsible for the day-to-day operations, so everything that happens on one shift. We run a shift schedule of 24 hours on duty and 48 hours off duty. And so everything that happens, people, trucks, stations, incidents, it's our baby.
So let me ask you this. Now, I want to make sure I have this right, because as I was looking at your title, battalion chief was there. But am I correct in saying there was a letter in your title as well? Was it Battalion Chief A? Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
What do the letters signify, if I may ask?
That is our shift. We have an A, B, and a C shift.
So you were at the start of this whole thing, yes.
I am, yeah. My radio designation is Battalion 1.
Battalion 1, okay. Now, as far as the firehouses themselves, are you based at a particular location, or does that rotate for you, sir?
Yeah, so my office and living quarters and everything is based out of Fire Station 1.
Okay.
Just up the road here. So the front half of that station has our fire administration, and then the crew quarters.
Okay.
And then down below is the apparatus. And then in the very back and kind of the forgotten corner is my bedroom, office, all of that, all mixed into one.
So at times, I can imagine when you were going through logistics and planning up the day, you have had plenty of those days where you have not left the office. Fair to say?
Very fair to say, yeah.
Oh, wow. Folks, again, you are listening to the Heart of the Emergency Worker podcast series here on Branson Podcast Network. Just getting started with our feature guest, Joshua Baim. He is battalion chief with Branson Fire, and this is exciting to me. You've listened to some of the episodes. I know we were talking before we went on air and before Pam arrived. We were just kind of getting acclimated with Josh, learning a little bit about his family life and his history. So, my friend, before Old Man Fire came calling and you started with his career, what was Joshua Baim doing before you got into fire?
You know, I've been doing this my entire adult life.
So when did you get started?
I guess I got started like right out of the womb. So I'm the
oh my gosh,
yeah. I love that.
So there's fire history amongst your family. Yes,
there is. Yeah. So
okay, that's cool.
I'm the fourth consecutive generation of public safety in my family. So my
wow.
great grandfather and grandfather were both firemen.
Okay.
And then my dad went over to the dark side and became a police officer, and he spent about 35 years as a police officer, and actually retired as the police chief in Columbia, Missouri.
How cool is that? So. Yeah. So fourth generation.
Yes, sir.
Grandpa was in fire. Your dad went the other direction, had 3 decades plus in policing. So was family history and the multiple generations in public service and rescue like that, was that the chief inspiration for you to make that decision to serve in fire?
Yeah.
Or was something else the root cause that drove you in, whether it was inspirational words from mom and dad or just seeing the family history?
You know, I think you can attribute it to both. I guess if you go way back, you know, I grew up in the fire station, the police station. I mean, my earliest—
That's a rare thing. That really is.
It is. And the fire station was a lot different than it is now.
I bet.
Generational was a lot different. I mean, my earliest memories when I was at my grandparents' house, my grandmother would pack up meals twice a day in picnic baskets and go to the fire station to feed my grandfather. And, you know, you'd go in and they had, you know, pipe smoke banked down from the ceiling, and they were sitting in their big chairs, and they wore the fancy hats and shirts and ties every day to fight fire. And they wore, you know, the long 3/4 coats and hip boots and rubber hats. That was their
wow.
And so, and we did every holiday at the fire station. They pulled the trucks out and they set up chairs in there. And so we did that forever. I mean, until, you know, I was in elementary school. My grandfather retired, so we did that all the way through elementary school. And then I went right in, and then, you know, I routinely would just walk into the police station. I knew every officer like they were another uncle or dad, and that was how I grew up.
See, at that, I mean, really, Pam, the way Josh talks about it, I mean, he had one of those rare examples of just being really in a career playground at such a young age, whether you realized it or not. You were the kid in a candy store, and you were seeing, I mean, family members and people that really just became your extended family, people that you hung around with as a kid. This is like larger than life heroes, and this is a big sandbox for you to see in real time as a kid.
Yeah, it's literally all I've known.
It reminded me when he was saying that,
I kept
thinking Mayberry kept flashing through my mind of, you
darn,
know,
darn
the,
right.
the whole town yeah. gathering at the fire station,
darn
you know,
right.
so that the firefighters didn't miss the holiday celebration or what. I mean,
yeah.
really, Mayberry. And then the other comment that just I loved, and we have not heard this one before, right out of the womb.
yes. And you're not wrong. Can I just say, I mean, the experience is one thing, but visually, what's the thing that hooked you the most? Whether it was seeing the bright red of the fire engines, or like every other kid, we dream about sliding down the pole in the firehouse,
right.
or trying on the gear for the first time, or getting a chance to ride on the truck. What was the hook?
You know,
if you
I
had
think,
to pick one above the rest,
if I could just say one moment,
yeah,
it actually wasn't my family. It was actually, and you may be aware of him. His name's Bill Westhoff.
Uh huh.
He's well known around town, but he hasn't always been from this town. He was a fire chief in Columbia, Missouri,
okay.
And his son is actually a fire chief in the Boone County Fire Protection District right there, right currently.
Uh-huh.
But I have a picture on a mid-30s fire truck where mm-hmm. I'm sitting on Chief Westhoff's knee doing a parade in the downtown square of Columbia. And I still have that picture. And
oh, cool.
I was, and at that moment, everybody along the street is looking at those people kind of almost in awe, you know, of they were real life superheroes. And I remember feeling that and just kind of the pride that everybody had. And that's what I wanted. And I knew it from a fairly young age that that's what I wanted to do.
The way he describes that, my imagery goes right to the movie Backdraft, where mm-hmm. Brian McCaffrey makes the time cover. And it's him standing alone, and he's holding his dad's fire hat in his hands. Reminds me so much of that. Wow. Okay, so childhood, amazing. What a rich history and service with your family, from your grandparents on down to your dad. Absolutely remarkable. And being able to see this through your youth, what that is just, that is the coolest thing ever. So your family, obviously growing up, Columbia, right? Am I picking up right? Uh-huh. Columbia is where you grew up. How young were you when you settled into Ozark Mountain Country in the Branson area? What brought you here?
In junior high, my mom and I moved to Springfield, Missouri.
Okay.
And so I was there. And when I finished high school, I started volunteering and working heavy equipment and stuff. But I volunteered with Logan Rogersville Fire Protection District, just to the east of Springfield.
Yes, yes.
And so I was there for a couple of years. And, you know, just very green, wet behind the ears kid, 18 years old, didn't really know much, you know, about this other than this is what I wanted to do. And there were a group of men that were coming down because Branson had an opening. Carl Sparks was the fire chief at that time. So we all tested, and I can shorten up the story by a lot, but they didn't hire me. And
oh, wow.
They didn't hire me. At that time, we had like 150 applicants for two spots.
That is a big is a big candidate pool. And that's surprising. I mean, because we're not
like
in a big area.
Well, it's not like that anymore.
Okay.
Anywhere in the country, it's not like that. But so they didn't hire me. And so I went home and was kind of licking my wounds. And was like, you know, I'm going to call him and find out why he didn't hire me. And so I called Carl Sparks, and he's another great man in our community.
Very much so. Well known.
And he talked to me for a few minutes, and he offered me a job anyway when I called him back. And so he hired me kind of on a whim. He's like, yeah, I think this is going to work out. And so he hired me for one of the two spots, and I've been here ever since. And that was October 14th of 2004 was my first shift.
Wow. I'm glad you picked up the phone and you called back.
Me too. It's been
one call can change your life.
That
right?
is right.
One call can change your life.
Yeah, remember that. If there's any kids, be bold.
What a wild ride that is for you to go in. You're testing. You're in this big, massive pool. Only two positions there. You make the call back. You get in. So, just I want to ask about just your mindset making the decision to go in and test and start this journey. Did you have any reservations? Did you have any fears about taking this on? It's a big decision to make. I mean, I have respect for anybody that goes into public service, law enforcement, fire. It's a big deal. It's a big decision to make. And to me, it's just as important as going into military service. Because in fire and law enforcement, there are no guarantees that you're going to come home at the end of the day.
Right.
Risk is there.
Let me
go back again to my question. So again, for you, How did you get your mind right? How did you come to grips with making the decision and saying yes to pursue?
You know, I think, and maybe I haven't served in the military, but maybe it's the same for the military. I think when you're a 19-year-old kid, risk is not something at the forefront of your mind.
You're not thinking about that.
You're not
per
really
se.
Thinking about that too much. You know, at that time, I was really thinking about two things. I want to be a fireman. I know I want to be a fireman, and I had a young lady that I was pretty fond of, and I told her we couldn't get married until I had a real job. And so I needed a real job, and they offered me a real job. And so for me, I guess not to really answer your question, but there really wasn't anything to think about. It was, I know that I'm going to do this. Branson seems like a really cool place to do it. This is the only place I've ever tested. You know, I never tested at Springfield or anything else. I took the test, got offered a job, and I've never left.
Pam, that's cool. And what I'm getting from Josh is driven, knows what he wants to do. He's going to go out and do it. So fireman, yes, you wanted to be that.
Yeah.
Also, this young lady, this special young lady.
Yeah.
You knew, okay, we're getting married. We're going to do this. We're going to build a family. We're going to build a life. I'm going to go and get that real job, and it's a done deal.
That's right, yeah. Yeah,
that was so
cool,
that
was the
man.
Final stipulation. I can't take you on until I can take care of you, so I need something other than an hourly landscape job.
Pam would be the first to tell you, and this is not the first time this question has come up. We do this a lot because as much praise as we put on our special guests, and we will do that with you before this episode is over with, just to show you our gratitude and appreciation for you making the decision to serve your community and do it well. We also put the praise on the family members behind the individuals, because they have to give you up to go into your career and go to work every day with that level of uncertainty there. So let me just ask for her, did she have any words of wisdom, some sage advice on day one?
Or hesitation.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. For her, what's that like for her? Because she has to make that decision to let you go out the door and go into uncertainty in your field.
Yeah. So she's a pretty remarkable lady. I don't know that she ever had any reservation.
Yeah.
She didn't offer anything but support. You know, when I came down here to take the test, mm-hmm. To do the interview process, I got invited to come to the next day of interviews. So I actually just rented a hotel room because I didn't want to drive back, probably too nervous to drive back. So she drove down here from Springfield to eat dinner with me, spend time with me. And so, you know, my wife has never offered anything other than 100% support in whatever I'm doing. So
you are a lucky man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's beyond luck. Yeah, it's very blessed.
That is really, really cool.
So, yeah, she's fantastic. She supports everything I do. And I do a lot of things in the emergency services, even outside of there, that I'm sure we'll get into later. And she supports all of them 100%. So it's pretty remarkable.
And one of the big things that we do, Pam and I, through this podcast series, is really giving people an unprecedented level of insight into the career. We want people to understand. We want to change opinion. We want to just better inform the public and really enhance appreciation. So going in as a cadet in your training, I'd like to know. I'd love to ask a question. What is cadet training like? How hard is it? And how much does it push you?
Yeah. So I guess we'll break it down into two different levels.
Yeah.
So there's initial training, like certification training.
Okay.
And there's several avenues to get that, but you know, you have to be certified in the state as a firefighter 1 and 2, and emergency medical technician through the National Registry to get in the door. That's like, you have to have that before you're even looking at a full-time career. And so our cadets, we actually have 5 starting, you know, right now. I think there's 3 that started this week or this week yet
to come. That's remarkable.
And so the recruit training, it's hard. So we have books that have hundreds of skills, individual skills down to the, you know, micro level that they have to master. And they have to master that within a time frame to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just, you know, it's not just, hey, throw the ladder up there, climb in the window, rescue the person, come back down. It's
like on the movies, right?
Right on the movies. Yeah. It's, which ladder, where is it on the truck? How are you going to throw it? There's a specific way. How are you going to put it up against the building? How are you going to enter the window? Every one of those steps is broke down into lots of little steps to teach them how to do it. And so, you know, some young men and women that we get, you know, they grew up around ladders and saws and stuff. Others are from the city and they've never seen a chainsaw. And so they have to learn everything. And so it definitely does push them. You know, I think the other thing that pushes them is firefighters are a very tight-knit group.
Yeah.
Particularly at that crew level. They spend 33% of their lives, their working lives, together. I mean, when you look at it that way, 33% of their time is spent with that group of people.
That to me is a massive bond that gets developed. That is
totally
a lot of time to be around your fellow cadet members.
Oh, yeah.
And you form a squad at that point, unless
you really
know, people
do,
get separated after the training is done. They go off to different firehouses. But in that process, man, you develop an appreciation that's unrivaled to the person that's next to you in that process.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Trust. You have to absolutely be able to trust the other person on your squad, right?
Absolutely. So when they get through that, you know, initial little bit and they get assigned their crew,
mm-hmm.
You know, that's their second family forever.
And you're the first one I've asked this question to, but I'm curious, and this helps the community understand a little bit. Training's hard. It's not easy.
Right.
Because you're going to get to that point, and I can just imagine from the outside looking in, there's a part of that training process where you try to get it as close to a real scenario as it's going to get.
Absolutely.
And that right there is going to push you right to the brink as far as what you can handle emotionally. In the training process, before somebody is a full-fledged fireman or firewoman mm-hmm. out there in the field, what is the one thing that is most likely to, I don't know, I mean, really that will break a candidate if they can't finish or they decide to walk away? What is that ultimate test that normally would push a candidate away? I'd just like to understand just on the stress level side of that.
You know, I think just from what I've witnessed, I think I can highlight two. One is the claustrophobia feeling. So one of the things that we have to do, you know, in like a house fire, you can't see where you're going. And mm-hmm. and so we have to make sure that when they're wearing all their equipment and their face masks, that they're okay in that environment. And so we have them do a confidence course, and their face mask is got a black hood over it where they can't see anything. It's hot. There's loud noises, and they have to crawl through tubes. They have to climb up and over things. They have to break out a section of drywall and get through the wall, find a firefighter, and then we're going to throw other elements in there, like tangle them with wires or something in that process to, like, hey, this is as bad as it could be, and we have to see how you react. So that's one thing, you know, that you see people are like, you know what, this isn't for me. Hopefully we find that out very early in the process.
And you have to push. You have to push to see what the threshold is, because when a life is on a line, a property is being defended. I mean, obviously, you know,
right.
Life first and foremost, anything else, you have to push to that level to see what the tolerance level is.
And their own life, right? If they're not prepared and mm-hmm. they're in that situation, uh-huh. then their life is in jeopardy.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, if we're in that environment, it's your life. You know, I refer to you as our customer,
yeah.
right? It's your life, it's their life, and it's mine.
Right.
And so you can't afford to have a weak link in a real thing. So you're right. We do have to kind of mm-hmm. find that breaking point of where that is prior to something being real. You know, in a controlled environment.
Yeah, and you talk about the visibility level in a burn situation, and you're going into a building, and you're not sure of the pathways, you're not sure of the route that you're going to take once you get into a home or mm-hmm. or a large structure fire situation. I mean, there are so many variables in there. The lack of visibility is one of them. Smoke inhalation, the burn risk. To train for that, I mean, it's almost like putting somebody in a sense deprivation scenario. You know, you're really you're taking certain things away to prepare you the most.
No, absolutely, and you know, they'll learn little things, like a trick I teach my kids sometimes. You know, like if it's dark and you're walking around your house, just close your eyes, right? And everybody's like, well, why would I close my eyes? Because you can't see where you're going anyway, and if your eyes are open, your brain's still trying to use them. Close your eyes, shut that sense off, and let your brain focus on things like your touch and your feel, you know, your feel and your hearing and stuff a lot better. And so they get a big kick out of those kind of things. But it's a real thing that people don't think about.
Josh, if I can ask in fire service then, so you got started at a young age.
Mm-hmm.
How much time have you clocked in to this point in fire?
In fire total is a little over 22 years.
Two decades plus.
Yep. At Branson Fire, it was... So October 14th of 2004, so coming up on 20 years.
Yeah. Wow.
So
He started 4 days before my birthday.
Oh.
Wow.
I was 11 when I started. That's what I'm going with.
Yeah, that well, again, hey, kudos to you. That is a long time to serve. Since that time and your career has developed, obviously mm-hmm. fire is one part of that. How has it branched out? How has your career changed? So fire is one aspect of this.
Yeah.
What all do you do in your career? What fills your day? I mean, so, obviously, we talked about the logistic. We got that, but what
right.
else
is there? So, my job specifically with Branson Fire, you know, I have administrative functions mm-hmm. in my day, policy review and rewrites, and occasionally like a grant proposal or a vehicle spec or something that mm-hmm. they need help with. But the bread and butter, what my job is to be there to serve each one of those crews.
Yeah.
And what they need. And then also serve as that frontline incident commander for any larger incident or more complex incident. So,
yeah.
Serious motor vehicle accidents. Mm-hmm. I go on all motor vehicle accidents that have injuries, but serious motor vehicle accidents, rescue situations, building fires, mm-hmm. special operations calls. I serve as the incident commander, kind of think of it as like the conductor of the operation.
And I want to ask this question because this is important. It goes right back to the heart of the mission statement of this. I mean, obviously, transparency, understanding, compassion, patience, all of that. What would you say, if you had to define it, would be the biggest community misconception when it comes to the fire department and fire service? To help us understand, what is something that we often misunderstand or that community misconception when it comes to the fire department?
Wow, that's a great question.
That you see a lot.
That is a great question. You know, I think sometimes, I think it's fair. I think sometimes misinterpret our humor or the way we react to things.
Yes.
And so, you know, there's been not specifically at Branson Fire, but I'm sure we're guilty as well. But there's been pictures, you know, that go around social media and you read the comment. You always fall in the trap of reading the comments and it'll be some, you know, horrific incident. And there's firefighters that are, you know, laughing or smiling or giving each other a hard time or whatever. And mm-hmm. and police officers and paramedics and EMTs. And some people think of that and like how disrespectful, you know, how calloused must you be to feel like that? And that's really the exact opposite of what's
Could
going on.
Could be the furthest thing from what's going on in a still photo. Yeah.
What's going on really is it's regular human beings that are seeing mm-hmm. and doing things that we're not designed to do. And it's the coping mechanism with those. Go back to that relationship, you know, that we've talked about. They spend a third of their lives together mm-hmm. and they do all of these things together. And so that's the reaction that you get is somebody will say some kind of joke or something just to break the tension.
Oh my gosh.
And,
yeah.
And I mean, so that's, and it never fails. Like when everybody's laughing for that 1 minute, that's when somebody's going to take a picture.
Of course, you know? That's just how it works.
Yes.
But I want to ask you something. And we've heard this from a couple of people that have been on here already. And It's to the point of when you show up mm-hmm. and there's been a tragedy, whether that's a fire, car wreck, whatever.
Yeah. Yep.
And, you know, I've heard several of our guests say, to us it's a routine call, but we always have to remember this may be the worst moment of this person's life, and we have to be very respectful of that. Even if it's routine for us, mm-hmm. this is still probably the worst day of this person or this family or whatever, their life. And so we have to be very respectful of that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I would even take that further and say that even if it isn't a routine situation for us, I expect my people to act like it's a routine situation for them.
Well, and you know, you talk about a deed, a word, and how, you know, people address a particular situation. Again, we got to have open eyes as community members, you know, thinking about that. The incidents that the fire team sees in the course of a day, it is varied.
Sure, yeah.
You know, the level of fire, single structure, multi-structure, car accidents. I mean, we don't know. We don't know how many calls somebody has been on. We don't know the severity of those particular calls. We're not in the shoes, so we don't know what's seen back to back to back to back. We don't know how difficult the day is. That's why this is so valuable. It helps us gain insight. Yeah. You know, I mean, and we don't know from each individual person's repertoire and how they deal with the situation. We don't know what the coping mechanism is.
Right.
You know, and we talk about, and we really got good insight from this. I talked to Eric Schmidt a lot, our police chief, and we talk about internal counseling within the departments. Mm-hmm. that helps our personnel come to grips with what they see in the course of a day. You know, we don't know what that's like.
Yeah, and you know, we've made public safety in general, not just the fire service, has made great strides in mental health care for our people.
That's such a big thing for you guys.
It's a huge thing. You know, that, I mean, even, I mean, gosh, 10 years ago it wasn't a thing. 10 years ago it was taboo to admit that something got under your skin. That meant that you were not a fireman. You were just here to be a firefighter. You weren't a fireman.
Yeah.
And that's really what it meant. And that it was kind of like a badge of honor of that doesn't bother me at all. And then when you look at it, stepping back, you know, like I said, four generations in my family, you look back and I look at the toll it took on all of the people in my family over a 20 to 30 year career. And it's astonishing. Mm. It's astonishing.
I asked this question of everybody that's been on the series. I don't think I've missed one yet. But I want to ask you, it's important to know, since you have been in the industry and you have been serving your community, if you had to put it out there, thinking about everything that you've seen, and you've seen a lot, two decades plus, what has been the toughest incident on the job for you, and what has been your most difficult day?
Yeah, so I've got an incident I can tell you about, absolutely. I think, though, if you talk to somebody that's been in this field for a number of years, there's not a corner in town that isn't attached to some kind of memory. There's just not. I mean,
you're the first person to say that.
I mean,
like that's awesome.
You know, we run, you know, we're going to approach, you know, 6,000 plus calls a year. We haven't always run that many, but you take the percentage off that, even if 10% of them were significant for you.
Jeez.
And you do that over a 20-year career, this isn't that big of a place, right?
We talk about small town a lot.
Yeah, so I can go to any place and tell you a memory. Now, not all of them are horrific or bad. Some of them are funny, but there's a memory attached to every place in this town. But for me, the most significant incident was actually not when I was on the line anymore. It was just after I promoted to battalion chief. And I do a lot of rescue stuff, like technical rescue stuff, outside of here. And so they kind of, I guess, look to me as, hey, you should know how to do this, right? And we got one of those situations that you can't prepare for. And it was down at the Royal Oak Charcoal Plant, which is actually in the county, Western Taney County. And they were dispatched as well as us. But our station, too, is very close to there. And I was the battalion chief on duty and went there. And a young man got caught in a bulk auger. And he was trapped to his waist in an auger. And, you know, we don't need details about that. But that was a strange sensation, because here's this young man who's conscious and talking. But we can't get him out. And there's not a foreseeable way to get him out. So we had to pull a lot. I mean, I even had our public works department, our mechanics, bring their truck over with air tools, like air sockets, to start taking nuts and bolts off of this big machine. And
you can't train for that.
There's no training for that. And the guys, both from Western Taney County Fire Protection District and Branson Fire, you know, worked together as one team. I got assigned as the operations chief inside, and we stood there for, gosh, I think it was 5 or 6 hours overnight, just working, dismantling this entire piece of equipment. And
just to free this young man.
Yeah, and he lived.
Five to six hours.
Yeah, and he lived, and he lived because of that teamwork that happened and thinking outside of the box. And, you know, like, one guy that we had there for Western Taney County, he's a mechanic by trade. And he's like, well, I can do this, this, and this. And another guy works with cranes and rigging from our department. And so he had come-alongs and change set up. And another guy used plasma cutter torches to cut stuff. And, you know, everybody just did a little bit different part, and nobody had ever trained for any of it before. And that was a pretty amazing event.
Wow.
You said it very uniquely. And, again, nobody has said it before you in this series about – every spot has got a memory.
Yeah.
And it can't be easy when we are in a small town, because you may end up going to that place that's got a memory more than once.
Yeah.
So you have to tackle, if there's something difficult attached to it and you have to go back at some point, you have to get over that initially to be in the moment to serve right then and there. I just want to ask you, as battalion chief, I mean, obviously, you have seen what you've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Young cadets that are going out on the job for the first time, full. They're past the training.
Yeah.
I just like to ask you just that process of being maybe that mentor, that voice when somebody has a difficult day and they come back and it's something maybe that you have already done in your career and you have to sit down with that cadet and you have to talk them through that.
Mm-hmm.
In any position, in any job, there's going to be that moment that creeps into your head where you're going, I've not seen this before.
Right.
What do I do? Have you had those moments? Have you had those conversations with a young cadet? And how do you tackle and how do you address that? That's got to be tough.
It is, you know, and I think really what people are looking for is they don't really care if you know what the answer is. They just really care that they've got somebody who has also been through a really challenging time that cares about them and is willing to listen to them. And I think that's really the best thing that I can offer sometimes. I mean, if I can offer advice to them or how I've dealt with things or how I didn't deal with things and I should have.
I think that's just as important.
It's very important, yeah. I mean, most of the old-time firefighters running here carry a lot of demons with them, and that's just the way it is. And if we can prevent the next generation from carrying that on, then that's a positive thing that, you know, I don't know if we can leave a better mark in the fire service than if we can leave the next generation healthier. But yeah, sometimes it's literally just being there and just say, hey, you know what? We don't have to talk about it. Maybe we'll just sit here and have a cup of coffee and be quiet for a while. And they're just not alone and they hear that. Maybe that's the best thing.
And sometimes that is just what you need. That does lead me down my next path with you. This is great. And again, folks, you're listening to the Branson Podcast Network. This is the Heart of the Emergency Worker podcast series. It is Pam Yancey, Josh Grisham in studio with Battalion Chief with Branson Fire, Joshua Bame. And Josh, let me just ask you this question, because you were talking about being there for your cadets. That's one aspect of this. 5 to 6 hours in a process of a rescue. That's one moment. That's one moment out of two decades.
Right.
I just want to ask you, with everything you've seen and done, how have you come to be able to separate Joshua Bame, Battalion Chief with Branson Fire, and Joshua Bame, loving husband and dad? How do you do that? And what has worked for you over the years?
You know, that this is a challenge for some people, but I, again, have been very, very blessed. I have a great family, you know. I've been married to my wife for 18 years this last summer.
Wow. Congrats, man.
And she's amazing. And I don't have, you know, she's understanding and I don't have pressure or anything at home. And so she has a very loving and kind environment to go home to, which makes it a lot easier. And then honestly, faith has a lot to do with it. Like, we're only in control of what we're in control of. And so I think that's a missing piece for some people.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that allows me to turn the switch off. You know, we were talking pre-show, I guess. We were talking about, you know, I'm involved in whatever my kids are involved in. And so, you know, my son just finished up a baseball season and he's going into football season, and I don't miss practices or games or activities, or I go to all of them.
And what's cool, you were telling me you get support from Ted, and that's like, what are you doing here? You need to be over there. You need to be in that moment.
That does not surprise me.
Yeah, he's amazing like that. And you know, that's just, you know, that's one part of it. Chief Martin is amazing at that. And also, you know, he professes faith openly.
Yeah.
And so there's no, I don't know what the right word is, but, you know, we're allowed to do that at work too. And we are encouraged to do healthy activities and be involved with our families. And I really feel like that's how you turn that switch. You know, like I feel like now I'm in a good enough spot that I can have a terrible day and night and be up all night and do silly, crazy things that happen, you know, in a shift, and immediately go home on a Saturday morning and you know, hug my kids, kiss my wife, and I'm done with it. And I'm just ready to enjoy the weekend. And then I can flip it right back on Monday morning and be ready to get back into it. And honestly, that comes because of the relationship that I have with my wife and children and then my faith. That's the two things that are kind of the pillars.
See, again, that just, Pam and I have said it several times over, and Pam, we can say it again here with Josh, is that it does, it takes a special person.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a special family.
It does.
And I tell you what, man, I mean, it just, there's a recipe there. There's a recipe that builds the person and puts a person together to be able to get in and make the decision to serve in these particular fields. But to do it tirelessly, to do it well, to be able to flip that switch and be a different person at home, and then to come in and not miss a beat on the job.
Mm-hmm.
There's something very, very special there. For community members, I want to go back to the cadets and the newbies
mm-hmm.
that are just getting started, or the five that are coming on board that are in there, to help us understand as community members, when they go through that process and they're out there in the field for the very first time and they're doing this, what are the long days like? What do they experience in the field? So what could be the potential call volume for somebody that is currently serving? And how long are the days, just so we understand better as community members?
Yeah, so at Branson Fire, we run a three-shift cycle.
Okay.
We work 24 hours on duty. Our shift starts at 7 a.m., like 7 a.m. this morning, and you get off at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning. So 24-hour shift, and then you're off for 48 hours, and that three-day cycle just rotates forever.
Okay.
Unless I switch shifts, I can tell you what day I work in 2030. Like, I know. It's on the calendar. Just count 3 days.
Wow.
That's the rotation. Now, as far as call volume and stuff, gosh, I will tell you, it's increased dramatically throughout my career. You know, when I got hired here, we were running 2,500 calls a year. Now we're going to break 6,000 calls a year.
Oh, my gosh.
The call volume is significant. But it's so varied.
So you could have a 24-hour shift, a minor.
Right.
You could have a 24-hour shift, a minor major. Or I imagine when it is really at its peak and it gets to be one of the hardest shifts you're going to experience, there is no minor. It's all major.
Yeah. You know, and the type of incidents change that. Like we may only have 9 incidents in a 24-hour period, but one of them lasted 6 hours.
Just as you said.
Just like that.
Yeah.
The other thing, you know, like 4th of July this year, you know, Branson Landing had their fireworks and there was people everywhere. And that was exciting to see. What the community might not know is that the fire trucks just in the city of Branson, I believe it was 72 runs in a 48-hour period.
Wow.
And so when you think about that, even the – let's go with the minor calls, right? The minor calls, they get out. They get out the door. They zoom to where they're going. They handle the situation. They come back. It's not done. They restock equipment. They have to write incident reports. They have to do all of these things. And so even a minor call, when you add it up, could take, you know, 45 minutes or so.
Can you – and hopefully you'll appreciate me saying this, because I'm it's important to me to frame this up in people's minds. Josh said it best. You know, you're thinking about one incident, 5 to 6 hours for one, right? You're in this 24-hour window, and as community members, I need you to keep this in your head just to understand this. The fire team gets back after a 6-hour response call, right? They just get back to the firehouse, and Josh is going to correct me if I'm wrong, but you come back after 6 hours, you're getting into the reset, right? You're restocking the truck. You just set your gear down, and then, boom, the alarm comes off within 5 minutes of getting back to the firehouse, and then somebody's got to go back out. Am I correct in saying that that happens?
All the time, yeah.
Oh my! And how? I mean,
it's not just coming. It's everything, you know. Like, you work out, and it's like, okay, I better go take a shower. If you have shampoo in your hair, you're going to get a call. I mean, I've been on numerous calls. Yeah, I mean, I don't have shampoo in my hair, but
Josh and I both, two Joshes, both bald side by side.
I would have shampoo.
You would have shampoo.
Yeah.
But I mean, I have been on numerous calls in this city where you come out of the shower, you put your T-shirt on just over the wetness because you don't have time to towel off, and you put on your bunker pants and you roll and you're sopping wet, or you have shampoo in your hair, or the soap didn't get rinsed off, and that's just how you go. It may be in the middle of a meal. That happens routinely. It may be that you that you're grilling or something, and you've re-grilled chicken 7 times because every time before you eat it, the call comes out and it's not quite done yet, and that's not delicious chicken anymore. You know, like that's just a normal thing that you sign up for and you get used to and you just laugh at eventually. Like that's just how it happens some days.
Boy, I mean, to be able to have a laugh in the firehouse and go back to Josh's words about squad members that you come up with, that you spend 33% of your time or more with these people and how important these people get just as a support system, yeah, to be able to give you a boost, whether it's through a joke or a kind word when you've got 5 minutes of downtime before the next call comes in and you're off and running. I can imagine how important the system is behind the scenes that we don't see. You guys pushing each other forward because you're into that 8th or 9th hour of 24 hours. You're tired. You're stressed. Yeah. We don't know the severity of a call that you just saw. But then when you go out after 5 minutes and you got to go back out again, the tables reset.
Yeah.
You guys, you don't get a bad day.
No.
I mean, you do, but you don't. You've got to set that aside because when you go to that next call, you have to reset.
Yeah, and that kind of goes back, you know, when Pam and I were talking about the routine call, and I made that comment of even if it's not a routine call for them, I expect my people to act like it's routine. And what I mean
like
by that is...
Like it's the first one, right?
Yeah, like what I mean is we're not panicked, we're calm, we're efficient, we know what to do. If you don't know what to do, don't let the person that is having a terrible moment in their life know that you don't know what you're doing. You put your game face on, you get the job done, and then we'll talk about it later.
I can't imagine anyone would be excited if they're in trouble, right? If there's fire, wreck, whatever.
Yeah.
I can't imagine anyone that would want a firefighter to show up and start crying, right?
Right.
Because
yeah.
of the so.
Or let's say that person is in call number 7. They're call number 7. And the fireman or the firewoman comes out there to serve at that point, they're still stuck in call number 6 or call number 5.
Right. But and so
right.
you
know what I'm
can't
saying?
Show those emotions. You have to be professional and yeah. and you may and it may appear like maybe you're not sympathetic or whatever, but I don't need sympathy. I need you to be on your top
we are
of your
problem
game
fixers.
And take care of what I need. And so it's the same thing, you know, with, you know, going to the emergency room at the hospital. You don't want a doctor that walks in and says, oh, my gosh, you just look, you know, you want someone
right.
to walk in and start in a professional way of assessing the situation and then making sure that you're taken care of.
That's
and I
right.
think that's that I'm sure it's hard. And I'm sure there's lots of times that you'd probably like to cry, you know,
oh, yeah.
if,
I mean,
you know, just because of the situation. But you also know you wouldn't be of any value. You wouldn't be able to help that person if you let those emotions
yeah, absolutely.
Take over.
And that's what we're paid to do. That's what the citizens
and you're trained
expect,
to do, right?
Because
it doesn't come normal, right? That
doesn't
come natural for someone.
I think
you've got to experience it. And I think repetitive the training that you were talking about, somebody you know being blindfolded and sent through that.
Yeah.
House, it's if you do it enough and you're trained well enough, it just becomes second nature to you, right?
I mean, that is correct. But I also would say that if it doesn't come at least somewhat natural to you, you're not going to be a
not
firefighter from
it.
The beginning.
Right.
But yeah, you know, that is our role. That is what, that is how we serve the community and the visitors to the community. That's how we serve our customers is we are professional problem fixers.
Yeah.
That's what we do. And sometimes that means, not showing emotion when you really, really want to. Sometimes that means making a really, really difficult decision mm-hmm. of maybe who lives and who doesn't.
Right.
That's just the reality of what we have to do. And you don't have time to analyze it. You
right.
just make your decision and you do it and you go forward. And I think that's probably one of the toughest parts as you know, the cadets, the new ones that are coming in, the toughest part of the job for them is the physical stuff. You need to perform at your best with no food and no sleep for a 24-hour period, which is crazy. Like when you think about, like, how would we feel if we didn't eat or sleep all day long? Right? It doesn't work right.
We'd be gripey, wouldn't we?
Yeah,
Josh?
I mean,
yeah.
And they are.
It's...
Firefighters are gripey. They just don't let you see it.
Well, I mean, again, you know, you sometimes have the misconception of thinking fire service is exactly like the movies. And it's not. It's not 100% like the movies at all. I think about Kurt Russell, Brian, and Stephen McCaffrey, and you know, he's like, you have a bad day here, somebody dies.
Right.
You know, yeah, that's a movie, and that's a glorified line, but there's aspects of that that's not wrong.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, you're right. That is very dramatized for Hollywood, and it wouldn't be a very good movie if they didn't do that, right? And I understand that, but yeah, there are elements of it that are true. You know, if people come into work and they're not mentally there,
yeah,
that's when accidents happen that hurt other firemen or they don't perform well on there. We have to be mentally checked in. We have to be physically checked in. And there is an element of, you know, call it kind of old school grit or toughness that has to go. I mean, we've been on incidents, you know, it's 113 degree wet bulb temperature right now. You know,
you are in full gear
and you're in full gear and you still have to do your job. We've also been in incidents where you have to go sit in the truck for a while because you can't unzip your coat because it's frozen solid because it's so cold outside. You still have to do your job. You know, if you're in a life threatening situation and I come in, I'm like, hey, I'd love to help you, but it's, you know, 16 degrees out here and it's raining and sleeting, and I just don't really feel safe doing that right now, you're not going to have a warm and fuzzy feeling about that. You want help now. You need help now.
Regardless of the elements,
regardless of the situation, regardless if we've had dinner or sleep or if we've had six or seven calls prior to that. It doesn't – every call, we really owe it to the people that we give them our 100% on every call. And – some of those calls, you know, I was listening to Jonathan Tudor from Taney County Ambulance District, and, you know, he made a really good comment there. He goes, it may be an absolute nothing call that if we were at home, we'd be like, eh, we'll go to the doctor on Monday or something. But to that person that called 911, it has them undone. It is a true emergency for them. We still owe it to that person to treat it like a true emergency, from the stub toe to the guy stuck in an auger. They get the same level of commitment from us.
It is a testament to the leadership. It's a testament to the men and women that make the choice to serve in the fire department here in Ozark Mountain Country that we, as the public in Ozark Mountain Country, would never be able to tell. You guys don't miss a beat when you're out there.
Yeah,
and that's a big, big deal.
We have wonderful people in our organization.
Fun question as we get ready to wrap up this episode, which has just been absolutely fantastic. Josh has delivered on all fronts. It's been a remarkable conversation. Fun question. This is the let our hair down question for Josh and Josh here and okay. Pam on the show, which is hilarious because Josh and I are wearing the exact same hairstyle. My friend, what is the best part for you of living and serving here in Ozark Mountain Country since you got started? What's the best part of it all for you?
You know, the best part for me is really just the community.
Yeah.
I get to serve in the community that I live, that my kids go to school in. I get to serve the families that we're friends with. That is a really big deal that is not lost on me. You know, we were kind of talking about it. You know, if one of my kids is involved in a sporting activity, you know, I get to go to that school or that sporting event and meet all of their friends. And then when we go to school for public education events or fire drills or whatever, I'll get 75 high fives from kids that I know on a first name basis. And that is pretty amazing because they go home and they tell their families, you know, that they saw me, and then I meet their families. And so I really think that's the best part of Ozark Mountain Country is just the community. It's a small town. We have a big city feel and a lot of things, but it's still at the heart of it. It's still a small town atmosphere that everybody knows everybody, and everybody's friendly, and there's so much support for public safety. It's just a great place to serve.
To me, that is who we are, right? And we are all so blessed to get to live and work and play and stay in Ozark Mountain Country.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I was talking to Ted about this when there was so many riots and everything going on, COVID and everything, and there was so much anger and aggression towards the police, the mm-hmm. fire, all that stuff. I feel like we were kind of protected right here.
Oh, I would agree.
And always was thankful for that culture. But to me, during that dark time in our nation, to know that people would stand up and support our police officers, our fire officers, it just speaks volumes about who we are here, mm-hmm. the culture that we are so protective of.
Yeah.
We love to take care of and help each other here.
Absolutely.
And I think that's why y'all are loved. I think that's why our police department, you know, our citizens truly love them and care about them.
Well, they
want to do the right thing for
their
y'all.
Community members.
Yeah.
It's hard to have a negative attitude towards, you know, Officer Smith or Firefighter Smith or whatever when your kids are playing baseball together, right. or you're in the same school,
yeah.
and or you go
yeah.
to church on Sunday with them and you sit next yeah. to them. I mean, you know who that person is and what their heart really is. And I think that that's one of the best things. We're not a big city where you don't know any of those people, which is a pretty cool environment to work in.
Yeah, and that's what Josh and I, when we were first talking about the whole idea of this, is like, so, you know, if you say police officer and you know, people get this vision of someone and maybe there's no face to it, right? It's just the uniform, you know, standing there, or police or fire as well. And so with this podcast, we want to humanize our emergency workers so that people see you as a real person.
Yeah, that's
and
great.
And we hope that when they do that, there's a sense of gratitude and appreciation and maybe a little more kindness and understanding of what you face every day. And if they don't hear your story, how do they know? Because Hollywood's telling that story, right? So
yeah.
we want to tell our story here locally. We want our folks to know who you are and appreciate you for the job that you do. And anyway, it's been a really interesting time today.
Josh. No doubt about it. You are listening to the Heart of the Emergency Worker podcast series. It is powered and presented by Arvest Bank here on Branson Podcast Network, hosted by Pam Yancey, Josh Grisham, with our very, very special guest, our latest hero that we get a chance to share his story, Joshua Bame. He is Battalion Chief with Branson Fire. Josh, I want to say thank you again for choosing to serve, becoming a firefighter, having that drive, with a wonderful family and surrounded by great community members. But I just want to say thank you for your decision to serve. Most importantly, coming in and sharing your story. It's been an honor.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure.
And one last question for you real quick, my friend. I'd love you to have the final word. But to your fellow servicemen and women that are in the field in fire, but also police, our emergency workers with the ambulance district around the counties, if you could tell them one thing to get them to come in and share their story, what would you most want to say to them to get them to come in and be the next hero we get a chance to honor?
You know, I think most of my peers in this do not like the spotlight.
Yeah, yeah.
I could tell you I was not super excited at the beginning to be here.
Yeah,
It's easy for us to talk statistics and talk about other people. It's not necessarily fun to talk about ourselves. And so I guess I would just encourage them and say it's not as scary as it sounds. And I think it's important that the community gets to see the human mm-hmm. that we are, the person that we are behind the uniform. I think it had great benefits for me personally and for the community.
Awesome. Again, it is the Branson Podcast Network, the Heart of the Emergency Worker podcast series. It is our opportunity to spotlight our everyday heroes that work in the emergency field, that serve our surrounding counties and our state proudly. These stories know no bounds. These men and women wear their heart on their sleeves. They're proud to live here in Ozark Mountain Country. But most importantly, they are proud to serve our community members. Everyday heroes are all around us. That's why this podcast series is built. We've got stories to tell. We thank you for joining us for this one.